to be able to find a creative partner of that caliber and that kind of brilliance, he's such a brilliant storyteller and such a wild imagination. It's work that never feels like work. It's just always fun. It's just like working with your best friend.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dustin Richardson from the Burbank International Film Festival. And today we continue our Real Conversations with special guest Greg Ruth. Greg is the New York Times bestselling author of The Lost Boy and has worked on many books and comics, including Our Enduring Spirit with Barack Obama, and both incredible graphic novels, Enday and Meadowlark, with his very close friend, Ethan Hawke. Not only is he an amazing author, he is an extraordinary artist, illustrating countless projects, including book covers and interior illustrations, DVD and Blu-ray jacket designs, billboards, magazines, newspapers, and screen-printed posters. His clients include Disney, Marvel, DC Comics, Netflix, A24, and Warner Brothers, and so many more. I'm a fan of both his crafts, and I'm very excited to be talking with him today. Hello, Greg. Thank you so much for joining me for a conversation. How are you?
I'm good, Dustin. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So I'm very interested in your work as an illustrator, and I was wondering if you could share with us a little bit about how you became a professional in this field to be working on so many fantastic and different projects.
Time and tenacity, I guess, is the short answer. I've been doing this a long time since, I graduated from Pratt in 93 in Brooklyn and started kind of working on this stuff in earnest right after. So I think it probably was within a year or two I started, I come from comics initially. So most of my stuff at the beginning was I had started working with Lou Stathis over at Vertigo at DC. I was in New York, so it was easy to kind of run up town to meet. And this is, 93, 94. This is pre-internet. This is pre-anything. We were faxing stuff back and forth at best. It was all hand delivery. And so it was a little bit different in those times. So any kind of advice or wisdom for how I came up is probably on par with as useful as someone telling you how best to get a Stagecoach mail delivery system in place these days. But I'd always done a lot of comics work, and I started out doing some small projects and stuff of my own. I was working with my good friend Spencer Lamb on some of the Matrix comics when the first film came out, and they wanted to do more comics work on the website. So we were able to kind of expand the world and come up with our own stories and our own takes on things, working with the Wachowskis and production company, kind of getting stuff up online. And that was early days of that kind of interaction between film and artists. They were really tip of the spear of this new thing that is now pretty commonplace these days. Fast forward to now, studios are even starting to develop their own kind of alternative movie posters for their own films. A24 and Netflix, they're all starting to kind of get on board with this kind of thing. I just did a thing for Lionsgate as well for a Steelbook. So I think trying to make physical media of film something valuable and precious is kind of a new thing, which is great. It's certainly great for me, for sure. I love movies, and it's great to dive into it. Certainly the Criterion Collection has been one of my all-time greatest gifts to work for. I'm doing another one for them right now, actually. I just can't get enough of that stuff. And doing a lot of LP work lately as well through Mondo and Death Waltz. Doing tons of soundtrack work. We just did a bunch of Dune LPs, and they're just kind of letting me run wild with concepts and idea. We're getting stuff through that I would have never expected to get through the kind of committee system that you got at these studios. So it's been an interesting time for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah, I absolutely love all the exclusive artwork that comes out, either with like the posters, like you said, or the different, like the Steelbooks. I love Steelbooks. I think those are so cool.
No, I know all this stuff. I mean, being able to, and I think that they're really throwing budget money at production quality, I think, is a way to make owning something matter more, having a physical thing mean more than just having a literal physical copy of something you can stream, but having something that is in and of itself its own experience. That seems to really be the goal. And so it's really rich ground for being able to do a crazy die cut thing, or having this Lionsgate thing is going to be amazing. The way the kind of plastic card interacts with the artwork and changes it the way we've done it. It's just a blast. It makes getting it and opening it, the whole thing becomes part of the experience and very kind of endemic and of a piece if you're doing it right with the film that you're kind of doing the work for. So it's a lot of fun, to be sure.
You mentioned Dune already, but and I know you really liked that, but was there any other favorite projects you were a part of? Was that one of them, Dune?
Dune was great. I mean, I've been a big Dune person since I first read the novel when I was 13. There is no way to describe what a great turnabout it is to get to work with everyone on that, to interact with Hans Zimmer and Denis. It's just, you know, there are dream. I've had a lot of dream projects that I kind of still can't reconcile with that I would, you know, if I was a kid, if I went back in time and told myself that I'd get to be doing this stuff, he would have just punched me in the face as a liar. There's just no way. I mean, Inde was amazing. I'd grown up down in Texas, as you know, Ethan was down there as well. And we both grew up with so many Native stories as part of our lives coming up, and didn't really realize, as many, I think, white eyes do later, that the stories that we grew up with were the shitty ones, and that we needed to kind of get educated to things. It was such an opportunity to kind of work with the community and interact with just the entire lore and that part of our American history, which we have a very hard time reconciling with even today. So that was a real honor. The stuff for Criterion has been unbelievable. Notorious was one of the first films that it was the first Hitchcock I ever saw. And it just absolutely, you know, captured me at 10 years old. It just blew my mind. I fell in love with Cary Grant and Ingmar Bergman and have been, you know, infatuated with both of them ever since. So being able to do Notorious for them was a gift beyond counting. I loved working with Neon and Bong on Parasite and then Memories of Murder. One of the real, I don't even know where to stop. There's stuff I'm doing now. I'm doing some more work for Neon. I'm doing an enormous amount of work for Mondo and Death Waltz on some LPs that I can't talk about. I wish I could, but they're going to be amazing. The stuff that we're doing for them now will make that, even that recent Dune LP look like a walk in the park. It's hard to list. Working with Ethan, I think, has been one of the highlights. He's been we've become real friends. It's like family now. And being able to, to be able to find a creative partner of that caliber and that kind of brilliance. He's such a brilliant storyteller and such a wild imagination. It's work that never feels like work when we're together breaking the story or we're working on something or developing anything that we're doing. I did an LP design for a soundtrack for his first directed film, The Hot Estate. And it's just always fun. It's just like working with your best friend on projects. It doesn't feel like, you know, the kind of job like that. So it's hard to draw a line. It's hard to pick favorites. I won't do the Sophie's Choice thing.
Yes, don't.
I'm bad at that.
No, I hear you. It is hard because everything, you put so much into it, and it's always, everything's such a different experience. I mean,
it is. It's been nice not doing gigantic big projects like another graphic novel at the moment, just because those things take so many years of being, you know, devoted singularly to one thing. It's been a lot of fun this last year just being able to hop from crazy dream project to dream project and just see them, you know, put them to bed and then pick up another one and run. It's a little overwhelming. I'm running about six simultaneously right now, so my head aches from it, but it's, you know, it's an uptown problem to say the least.
You have a dog.
I do. Let me see. Birdie, up, up.
Come on. Can we say hi? Oh, hello.
Yeah, he's my studio partner. I think he's telling me that there's somebody outside that needs barking at. I'm not paying attention. No, you'll have to wait. Be a good boy and stay here. Yeah.
Oh, what a good partner.
Yeah, he's all right.
You're right together.
Well, he's still only 9 months, so he's not quite there yet.
Oh wow. Yeah. Oh well, great. Well, he can hang out with us. I really, really love how all your work, it looks so realistic. It almost looks like an actual photograph sometimes. I mean, pretty much all of them. I mean, sometimes when I was reading Meadowlark, I just kept thinking like, oh my God, this is fantastic. It looks, especially because you have one of the main characters being like played by Ethan Hawke as an illustration. Yeah, I love that. I think that's so great.
Oh, thanks. There was a funny story with that one. We were talking about Meadowlark. The boy is really largely rooted in our experiences with our own kids, his Levon, my Emmett. And he certainly looks more like Emmett than anyone else, for sure. but I was having a really hard time picturing Jack, the dad, and we really were going around and around and around. And he had just gotten off of shooting Magnificent Seven and had this big long beard that he had grown. And he was in the process of shaving it off. Like anybody who grows a big beard for anything, you kind of have fun, whether you want to carve a monkey tail or do something ridiculous before you completely get rid of it. And he had carved everything off with this handlebar mustache and sent me a selfie. And it was like a slap in the face. I spit all the coffee through my nose and I immediately was like, that you're him. You know, we're going to base it on you. And I don't know that he knew seriously that I was actually going to follow through with that until the pages started coming in. And then it was really wild and fun. It was interesting. I've drawn Ethan a lot prior to that anyway. So I had a pretty good handle on him. And I had, of course, access if I needed. We spent a lot of time together on that. So that was fun. Yeah, no, I'm glad the way that worked out. And there's some really very cool news regarding that book coming. And I'm not quite sure I can speak to it yet, but.
Oh, cool. Well, nice. I look forward to hearing what that is. Because yeah, I absolutely loved that book. I thought it was fantastic.
Okay, thank you.
Could you talk just a little bit more about your relationship with Ethan on making a piece like this? Like, how do you balance out the work together? Because you're both involved with both illustrations and the writing process, correct?
Well, he doesn't regard. Do any art. Yeah, he doesn't do the artwork, but he kind of takes at that. Once we get into principal page making, he'll take a back seat a little bit in a more editorial stance with regards to how the art looks, you know, making it work and function. He'll be the first reader, you know, of the piece. So it really helps. I think I started to realize, I think it was The Lost Boy that taught me the value of writing a fully drafted out, very detailed comic script as if you're handing it to another artist to do it. It always struck me as a little bit duplicative and stupid to do it for yourself. I had originally written The Lost Boy as I was drawing it, which basically meant we had, oh my God, there must have been 60 or 70 pages of art for that book that never saw light of day because editorially it wasn't working with the stereo, or we made changes and, you know, stuff got discarded. It's a very clunky way to make a book and make it work as well. I mean, what I thought was a restriction actually ends up becoming the kind of fences make freedoms kind of moment. When you have a script that's down there and it's detailed and set, it doesn't mean you're enslaved to it unless you want to be. You, even especially if you're also the artist, I'm much less obligated to please the writer if I'm also the writer. So the first thing that we would do is Ethan and I would spend a lot of time talking and just working through characters and talking about stuff that we think would be cool or coming up with dialogue or emailing back and forth. A lot of Metalark broke with us kind of hollering at each other on across the aisle on airplane flights when we were on book tour for Inde. We developed most of that in the back of, you know, cars being driven to events, or, you know, in an airport at 3 o'clock in the morning, just talking about the character and what does this do and what would this happen and if we broke it this way. And, you know, and he's got such an absolutely insanely brilliant mind in terms of organizing storytelling and making those kind of effective decisions. It just, most of our interactions beginning is entirely vocal and we're both clicking away on our laptops trying to put stuff down. I think then after that, it's always a little bit different each time. Meadowlark had us going back and forth, you know, doing versions of a script and sending it back and forth and doing edits on one part while the other one wrote the next and kind of doing those handshakes. And a lot of it was also just going to Brooklyn and sitting in his office and kind of just spending hours and hours and hours writing and walking around and acting out scenes and getting into arguments with each other that are supposed to happen on the page to see how they work in terms of natural flow and dialogue and making sure everything locks up with characters. And so we spent a good year or two just doing that and writing that script. And once that gets locked in and done, and then turned into a publisher and then edited and approved and all that stuff, I'll then start in on the artwork. And that's when Ethan then has to take a kind of a more editorial approach to things. And I tend to try to keep turn-ins to a scene at a time. So like the scene where Jack goes to pick Cooper up from his house and then has to get on the phone and realizes that he has to go and bring him to work. And, you know, that whole moment that happens is about 5 or 6 pages. I'll just do that block and then I'll send it to Ethan. And oftentimes by now he's on set. So he'll get the email, and then in between shoots, or if he's in the trailer, he'll be on set looking at stuff, and then he'll send me notes, or we'll get on a call and immediately start talking about what we're doing, what's working, what's not, let's adjust this, and we'll kind of debate going back, and then we'll do the next scene, and then we'll do the next scene, and the next scene. And then we get to the end of the book, then we'll go back and go over the whole animal just over and over and over again, tighten up dialogue, rewrite stuff. By then you've come up with a better idea for a scene. So sometimes the dialogue gets completely junked and rewritten. Sometimes that means that the new writing requires new art to be put in there, or that the pacing is funny and we have to break things up and add more things. I think that whole scene with him giving, they're on the run from the cops and they're running after these bad guys, and he's got this knife in his leg. And we thought, what a great time to have a father-son driving lesson moment in there, you know, like how weird that would be, and constantly being aware of how that kind of happens. You know, you can literally walk out of your house, it's on fire, and you've rescued your cat, but you've lost your dog, and it's all just chaos. And there's a kid walking across the street with an ice cream cone. There's always mundane stuff in life that's happening while you're in these insanely intense moments. And I love the interplay of that. And I know that we spent a lot of time laughing and going crazy over that. I think, I can't remember if he came up with it. I think he may have initially done. I mean, one of the things about when you know a writing partnership is really going well and is egoless is when neither of you can remember who came up with what, but it works and you don't care, you know? And there was that, I think it was him that when Cooper was finally like realizing like I'm in too deep, there's no way I can do this, I need help, I'm calling the police, I'm going to tell them what's going on, I cannot be responsible for what's about to happen. I think it was his idea to have the operator the whole time keep thinking, because he's so young and he has a high voice, that he keeps calling him ma'am and lady and slow down. He says, no, I'm not a woman. I'm you know, like, it's not a prank call. And like, and suddenly like this moment where he's trying to earnestly reach out for help, and he's dealing with this kind of bureaucratic, silly, half listening nonsense going on the other side of the line, is this great moment of comedy that's happening at a time simultaneously with this great desperation, was so fun to do. And we spent so much time recutting those pages and reworking that dialogue and getting those beats down and trying to continuously be honest about how to express his frustration and his desperation, while also still making it really funny to the reader while they're reading it, how absurd this is. So it's that kind of stuff that I take great joy in, you know, on its own. And I think when you're done and you look at it and it works and it's alive and the story is telling you how it wants to write, and you feel like you have stopped being a master of the thing you're making and you become kind of a subject executing the commands of itself, that's when you know you've created something that's alive. You know, you've put electricity into Frankenstein's monster and he's sitting up and he's asking for a sandwich. You know that whatever has happened, that's a success. You've given life to the lifeless, and now you kind of get to help be its caretaker to a lot of degrees. So it's great. It's really addictive.
Was there any illustrators or artists that influenced you as a child?
Well, I grew up in Texas in a very non-art environment. As a child, the only things I kind of knew about were really, you know, Van Gogh at the museum or whatever was going on at the Fine Arts Museum in Houston. And they have some tremendous galleries there. The Menil Museum down there was amazing. And Magritte was a huge love of mine and still is today. I think they've got one of the largest collection of Magrittes at the Menil. They have a great Rothko chapel down there near that place as well. I used to love to go to, but it wasn't really until high school. I went to a performing and visual arts high school down there. That's when it really kind of took hold and it became kind of a launch point. It was the only thing that I did well. It really saved my life. I wasn't doing great in junior high school and really just felt lost. And I think my mom saw that the only thing I seemed to really constantly be spending my time alone in my room doing was art, was making things, drawing things, making stories, and even making little comics and stuff like that. So I think she picked up on that, made me apply to it. I got in and it just changed my life. And there's been no looking back ever since.
Could you tell us a little bit about your process creating these pieces? Like what's involved to make these illustrations?
It all largely kind of depends on the project. Sometimes there's different stuff going into it. So like the Dune original soundtrack had me like creating my own kind of sand and spice physically and kind of, you know, making props for that and photographing it and trying to use design elements in a way that was really interesting. You know, there's projects where I'm hitting it from a Sumi ink kind of drawing perspective. And so I'll sit down and do that. I just did a bunch of stuff for Godzilla that was all in just big rough charcoal. So any chance to be able to kind of try something new out, I'll leap at it if I can. I get really bored with myself really quickly and always neurotically nervous about, you know, reruns of myself. Although, which is a weird thing because in our thing, if you do something right the first time, all a lot of people want you to do is more of that again and again and again, not really recognizing, I think, at the end that you get this repeated diminishing returns every time you keep hitting the same trick over and over again. So sometimes I have to push back on desires to do something that isn't really compatible with anything other than just trying to draft off of the look of something else that was happening. And I get the instinct, and a lot of publishers and studios they prefer proven things. So it sometimes becomes in that way, but I'm working on a series of LP soundtracks right now that are an interesting mix of graphite drawing. I tend to always like to work practically. I'll assemble in Photoshop later and work on it. I'm not really great with color. It's just not a natural instinct for me. I tend to be very tonal thinking. I prefer black and white. I love old Carl Theodore Dreyer films. I love the old noir. So for me, it's always about lighting and shadow and form. So color is a natural second thought, and Photoshop gives me a lot of room to really experiment with it without committing to a place where I have to keep destroying and restarting from scratch. I can kind of dial back a mistake or a wrong turn, which invites more risk-taking, which creates better work. But largely, I'll always do something as much as I can practically and then scan it in into a computer and then work with it on top of that. And even the colors are usually, I have a huge bank of scanned in dirt that I put on the scanner or old paper textures or watercolor washes. And then I'll use those rather than try to go to digital stuff because it tends to not mesh as well with the practical drawing. Some things can get a little bit more hyper-photographic, like I'd say a lot of the stuff for Dune and some of the things I'm working on right now. Certainly some of the work that I did for The Hot Estate was really, they were meant to look like old Polaroids, so very, very photographic and crisp in certain areas, but kind of distorted and blurred as Polaroids are in others, and that's been fun to do. And I will try to draw that as much as possible. I did a series of my own just to test out a technique of doing portraits of all the 13 Doctor people that play Doctor Who and have them get blurrier as they go down the line back in time, and trying to learn to kind of mimic photographic depth of field and blurries and distortions that can come photographically, but trying to do it with a pencil. I've done stuff like that and applied that to work a lot. You know, drawing smoke or water or any kind of thing that seems like, you know, in some ways there's a practical reason to do something photographically, but you don't have the kind of universal control of it. I had a gig at Criterion for a film called Breaking Point, which is an old noir. And it was one of the rougher assignments from them. And by their own admission, there was something turgid about. Basically, they had a scene from the film that they wanted to use. There were some compositional problems with the way that particular scene was shot. So what they really needed to do was have things moved around. And there was really no way to do it without redrawing it from scratch and drawing it correctly. So that was one of those incidents where a hand-drawn thing was required. And it was my ability to kind of hand-draw it and make it look as close to the original screenshot as possible that allowed us to do that. We were able to compose it and work with it and edit and make that happen. You can't do that without an artist, you know, practically working in that way. That wasn't the funnest event I had to do, but I love the challenge of doing something like that. It was really interesting and really cool. I like the kind of intermix of when I did the work for the piano, that was another dream gig. I love Jane and her work, and especially the piano. To be able to use, you know, a realistic moment from the film, and then insert my own kind of graphic elements or symbolist elements to how that image is told, so that it expresses more than just is what's seen on the paper, on the package that you've got, is really where I like to go. So it, project to project, it just depends. Whatever it demands or whatever idea it sparks in me. I'm lucky enough to have either completely insane art directors and editors, or very trusting people that kind of just say, all right, that sounds great. I don't know what you mean, and I'm a little scared, but you go for it and let me know. You know, the Godzilla stuff, they really just let me go hog wild. I don't think that they really thought that we'd ever get approval for it from Toho, but they loved it. It's been great. So all steam, you know, full steam ahead on the crazy. More to come for sure.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing all that. What Godzilla was it? Was it one of the recent stuff, or it's more the classics?
No, it's all old classic stuff.
Nice.
I can't specifically say yet. One of the things in the last 6 or 8 months has been almost every project I've done is all NDA, quiet, hush-hush stuff that I have to wait for it to come out. And it's frustrating, you know, because I'm used to comics. When you work in pamphlet, you know, regular comic book style comics, the gratification is fairly instant. It's a rough ride. You've got a month to turn stuff in, but it hits the stands the next month, and you're able to actually hold the thing you did weeks after you turned it in. It's tremendously immediate, you know, in that way. When I moved into books and book covers, you're looking at years before you actually can hold the thing in your hand, the project. You know, even by the time you're done with like a graphic novel or a book like that, there's a full calendar year before it even gets announced and then put out there. And then you have to go out and do press for it, for a project that is more than a year old for you. And you're already working on something else. And it can be hard to remember what you were thinking and doing at the time, or even feel like you even know what to say, because that thing isn't so in the rear view at the point. The posters are a little bit quicker, and that's been great to see. But a lot of this stuff, since it's being tied in with specific projects that are coming out later, it requires a lot of patience. Again, it's just more uptown problems, but it's, you know, it's nice to hold the thing you make, you know.
Oh, yeah. A comic book a month. That's amazing. Could you talk a little bit more about that process? Because there's so many drawings involved for just one comic.
Oh, yeah. It'll kill you. I did a series of six men. It was a self-contained story that had never been told about the character before. I was brought in to help the artist that was working on the actual practical series, who was starting to fall behind, because it's a lot to do month to month. I mean, it really is. And even though they front load, and, you know, you usually want to get 2 or 3 issues in the can before you start that process, it's not hard to burn through your fat and get down to the bone real quick before the next one comes. And they were finding that they were running into that. And the last thing in comics you want to be is late turning in anything. It's not, there's a lot of practical prohibitions against that. Comics, I don't know if that's still the same, but in the direct market back in those times, if you miss your window, your comic books are returnable. So it's a way to encourage independent shops to order copies of something weird that maybe they wouldn't necessarily do. Like, you know, they know they sell Superman, but Stray Bullets is like kind of a gamble for them. So they don't want to put themselves at risk for it. So they kind of give you a little bit of freebie for that. If you don't, they become returnable if you're late, and it can cost thousands and thousands of dollars to the publisher in returns that they are responsible for coming back. And I know that some companies, it's even been so bad that it's almost threatened to shut them down. I know Dark Horse went through a rough period when they had a massive returnable thing hit them. So it's, you know, it's a periodic industry like newspapers or magazines are. So you've really got to go, and deadlines are short. Notices are really short as well. So you've got to kind of get to it and learn to be very fast and very brief and very concise, which, again, all of that is entirely great training for any other work. Because when I am doing something right now that is on a hugely crunched deadline, it would have been Whereas normal guys that I think that don't have comics training will take weeks to work on a piece, I am able to get done in a couple of days and get it out because I'm so used to that kind of hyperspeed, crackhead, crazy schedule. It's allowed me to kind of get going. So for Conan, the idea was to take the kind of 6-issue arc that I was doing with Kurt Busiek and break it up and use it as kind of filler. In when they were suddenly found that they're getting really close to running out of runway with the ongoing team, they'll plop another one in. So it kind of showed up every 3 or 4 issues to try to keep that ball in the air, which was a very smart way, I think, to do it. And it was such a stylistically different approach. It was a nice pause, I think, for everybody, but it also didn't make you feel like that you were being forced to wait for something. You got kind of a whole other thing to do. So I had time on that. But I remember I was doing the first issue of that Conan while I was working on the last issue of Freaks of the Heartland in the same month of August. And it was a rough month trying to get two. And back then I'm doing fully painted work. I'm doing all of the kind of layout and the design. So it's really an enormous amount of time. When I moved into book publishing for The Lost Boy and then on to Inde and Metal Arc and so forth, book publisher on a yearly schedule. It's not month to month, it's yearly. So you do have time. I think we were supposed to launch Metal Arc a year earlier and I needed more time to wrap it up. And so we bought ourselves another year. Now, all of this turned out to be a great blessing in that if we had come out the year we did, it would have died on the vine because of the pandemic. A buddy of mine I know had a book land literally the month after it broke out here and it just swallowed. I mean, I don't think there was press. The publisher was shut down. It just ruined it. I mean, that's years of work just lost. And it would have been great if it had come out this year instead of last year because we still didn't get a proper book tour out of it like we did with Inde. It lost a lot of ground as a result of not being able to kind of get out there. Books really benefit from that kind of hand-to-hand kind of interaction and kind of being there and finding readers and meeting them and handing out books and letting those people recommend it to 5 other people and so on and so on. You get that exponential growth and you don't really get that with an e-marketing campaign or, Zoom stuff. But it was great. We were able to do a really great chat with Rick Linkletter for the Texas Book Festival and make it work. But I hadn't seen Ethan. It was so weird. I think it'd been a couple of years where I hadn't even physically seen him in person because of the pandemic while we were still working on this project remotely. So the technology gives you that ability to do that. But at the same time, it's the lack of actual contact stinks. I think I like that part of it. I miss it. And like any book, it's always that way. You spend all this time, you make it up, and then you get that box, from the publisher, you get your comps, you haven't seen it. You've seen proofs and you've approved of all the stuff and you hope that it works out well, but you never really know. And a lot of the times there's always a certain disappointment into what you were hoping it looked like versus what it actually does look like. But Hachette and our amazing editor there, Gretchen Young over at Grand Central, the production value of both Inde and Meadowlark were just, I've never been surprised in this looks so much better than I thought it would ever or could be. And I've been getting a lot of that lately too, especially with the LP stuff we're doing and the posters for Mondo have been breathtaking, the stuff that they do. So it's really nice to be surprised in that direction for sure.
All right. Well, hey, Greg, thank you so much for sharing your stories and experiences and let us into your process today. And thank you so much for being here. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
It was a great time to talk with you. I'm always happy to talk about this stuff. Thanks.
Well, everybody, to learn more about Greg and his amazing work, make sure to check out gregthings.com, where you can view many of his illustrations and also shop for some, and so much more. And don't forget to check out his books, which are available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. All links are in the description below. You won't be disappointed. And learn everything you need to know about the festival at burbankfilmfest.org.